This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Nobody likes a smart bacteria. The growing number of antibiotic-resistant germs is causing health officials around the world to find better treatments for infection.
When penicillin was introduced, most isolates of Staph aureus were killed by the drug. But by the 1960s, over 80% of Staph aureus isolates were resistant to penicillin.
On today's Health Show, we'll learn about antibiotic resistance and how the scientific community is coming together to fight the problem.
We'll also talk to a leading activist in the movement to stop bringing genetically modified foods to the market, who has been hailed as a voice of reason and dismissed as a blatant liar. And we'll find out how parents can make this a healthier school year. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Antibiotic resistance is a serious and growing problem around the world. More and more, healthcare workers are having to scramble to treat patients when long-time reliable antibiotics become less effective against germs that are constantly evolving. Here to give us an overview of the problem is Dr. Alex McAdam, an associate professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Infectious Disease Laboratory. We spoke recently about the scope of the problem.
This is a very broad question because of the great diversity of bacteria that cause infections and the many drugs that are used to treat infections. That said, there's a general consensus that antibiotic resistance is a common, serious, and growing problem. Let me give you a couple of specific examples to illustrate the problem. Staphylococcus aureus, or Staph aureus, is a bacterium that is a common cause of many types of infections, including infections of the bloodstream, joints, bones, and lungs. Without antibiotic treatment, many invasive Staph aureus infections would certainly be fatal. When penicillin was introduced for clinical use in 1942, most isolates of Staph aureus were killed by the drug, and penicillin treatment was usually effective for these infections. But by the 1960s, over 80% of Staph aureus isolates were resistant to penicillin, and now over 90% are resistant. In 1961, methicillin was introduced for clinical use. Methicillin is an antibiotic that's useful for treating penicillin-resistant Staph aureus infections. Isolates of Staph aureus that are killed by methicillin are also killed by several other related drugs, including the first-generation cephalosporins. Such drugs became the mainstay of treatment for infections with Staph aureus. Unfortunately, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, has become common, as many people know from reading the newspaper or watching the news on television. In the U.S., many studies have found that from 1 to 2/3 of clinical isolates of Staph aureus are resistant to methicillin and the related drugs. Because of this, many physicians no longer use these drugs for empiric treatment of infections caused by Staph aureus. There's recent evidence that the frequency of invasive infections with MRSA in the U.S. is actually declining a bit, which is certainly good news. For many years, vancomycin was considered to be effective against all isolates of Staph aureus, including MRSA. While vancomycin remains very effective for nearly all Staph aureus, there are a small number of reports of infections caused by vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus. Fortunately, these highly resistant bacteria have not spread from one person to another person. In addition to vancomycin, there are other antibiotics, both new and old, that are effective against most isolates of MRSA, so these infections can still be treated. But the treatment has become complex and can require expensive drugs or drugs that cannot be given orally and must be given intravenously. A second example that illustrates the problem of antibiotic resistance is the bacterium Neisseria gonorrhea. As the name suggests, this organism is the cause of the sexually transmitted infection gonorrhea. During the 1990s, fluoroquinolone antibiotics could be conveniently given in a single oral dose to effectively treat gonorrhea. But in 1999, fluoroquinolone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea were first detected in the U.S., specifically in Hawaii. The frequency of fluoroquinolone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea subsequently increased, and the resistant bacteria became widespread in the U.S. As a result, in 2007, the CDC said that fluoroquinolones should no longer be used to treat gonorrhea. After that, only one class of drugs, third-generation cephalosporins, was recommended by the CDC for treatment of gonorrhea. Until recently, either oral or injected cephalosporins were recommended by the CDC for treatment of gonorrhea. Unfortunately, resistance to the oral cephalosporin has become common in many parts of the U.S. This August, the CDC issued the recommendation that the injected cephalosporin should be used for treating gonorrhea rather than the oral form. Injected treatment is obviously painful and less convenient for patients. I can provide more examples, but I think that these two illustrate that bacteria rapidly develop resistance to antibiotics under the selective pressure of exposure to these drugs, and also demonstrate some of the challenges this presents for patient care.
Well, Doctor, in general terms, what are the mechanisms of antibiotic resistance in bacteria?
To understand how bacteria become resistant to antibiotics, we have to first understand how antibiotics work. Each antibiotic interacts with a specific target molecule produced by bacteria. That bacterial target molecule performs a function that is essential for the growth or survival of the bacterium. The antibiotic specifically inhibits the target molecule from performing that essential function, and so the bacteria can't grow or they die. To inhibit the target's function, an antibiotic must do three things. First, the antibiotic has to reach the site of its molecular target. Second, the antibiotic has to persist at the site of the target long enough to have its effect. Third, the antibiotic has to bind to and inhibit the target molecule's function. Bacteria become resistant to an antibiotic by preventing one or more of these three steps. So first, a bacterium can prevent an antibiotic from reaching the target either by blocking the antibiotic from entering the site of the target or by rapidly pumping the antibiotic away from the site of the target. Most targets of antibiotics are found inside the bacterial cell, and so gain or loss of a pore or pump molecule in the bacterial membrane can change whether an antibiotic will reach its target. Second, antibiotic can make enzymes that modify the antibiotic in such a way that the antibiotic is no longer active. And third, bacteria can change the target such that the antibiotic can't inhibit the target. Bacteria can do this by having a different or altered form of the target, or, less commonly, by expressing greatly increased levels of the target to escape from inhibition by the antibiotic.
Where did this all begin? Where did antibiotic resistance originate?
Most antibiotics in clinical use are derived from natural products produced by bacteria. These naturally occurring antibiotics are made by bacteria found in the environment, presumably so that the antibiotic-producing bacteria can inhibit the growth of the neighboring antibiotic-susceptible bacteria. That gives the antibiotic producers a growth advantage. Now, here's the really interesting thing. Antibiotic resistance occurs in environmental bacteria, even in bacteria that are isolated from environments that, as far as we know, contain no antibiotics from man-made processes. This reflects an arms race between different bacteria, with antibiotic resistance emerging in environmental bacteria in response to their antibiotic-producing neighbors. Also, the antibiotic producers must have ways to protect themselves from the inhibitory effects of the antibiotic they make. And so this is another potential source for the origin of genes mediating antibiotic resistance. DNA-carrying genes for antibiotic resistance traits moves between bacteria by several different mechanisms, and so antibiotic-resistant bacteria can donate these antibiotic resistance genes to other bacteria. Eventually, these genes find their way to the pathogenic bacteria that infect humans. Antibiotic resistance can also be created de novo by exposing antibiotic-susceptible bacteria to an antibiotic. This occurs through point mutations in the DNA of the bacteria, which leads to antibiotic resistance by the general mechanisms we discussed earlier. This can happen whenever bacteria are exposed to antibiotics, whether in the laboratory, the environment, or within a host such as a human or an animal.
So what's driving the increase in antibiotic resistance in bacteria?
The increase in antibiotic resistance is caused by the selective pressure exerted on bacteria by exposure to man-made antibiotics. Of course, antibiotic-resistant bacteria have a growth advantage over antibiotic-susceptible bacteria only when there are antibiotics present. We usually think about antibiotics being used to treat humans who have infections. There's very strong evidence that the use of antibiotics in humans increases the frequency of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in human infections. Some people may be surprised to learn that antibiotics are also used in low doses in animal feed to enhance the growth of livestock in the agricultural industry. Estimates are that about 70 to 80% of the antibiotics used each year in the U.S. are used in food animals. There is contentious debate about whether the use of these antibiotic growth products, or AGPs, for livestock results in increased resistance to antibiotics in human infections. A number of professional medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics, have concluded that use of AGPs carries a risk for human health due to an increased risk for infections due to antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Is anything being done to reduce the use of antibiotics in animal feed?
Several countries have banned the use of antibiotics for growth enhancement of farm animals. Sweden was the first in 1986, And they made this decision following a request from the Federation of Swedish Farmers. Several European nations have followed suit, and then the European Union banned all AGPs in 2006. Progress has been somewhat slower in the U.S. My understanding is that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has mainly used voluntary measures to discourage the use of AGPs. For example, in April of this year, the FDA asked drug makers to voluntarily change the drug labels on antibiotics to require a prescription from a veterinarian for use in animals. The expectation is that veterinarians will refrain from prescribing antibiotics for use as AGPs. At times, the FDA has taken stronger measures. This year, the FDA restricted the use of cephalosporin antibiotics in cows, pigs, chickens, and turkeys. There is some pressure for the FDA to move more decisively. In March of this year, a U.S. magistrate judge ruled that the FDA must act on its long-shelved plan to limit the use of penicillin and two types of tetracyclines in animal feed. However, the FDA leadership has filed an appeal to overturn this decision, and the question is still in the courts.
Well, finally, Doctor, what other steps are being taken to combat the spread of antibiotic resistance?
It's clear that there are many effective measures we can take to reduce the risk of infections, including infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Appropriate use of antibiotics in treating human infections is critical for reducing antibiotic resistance. That means using antibiotics only when they are truly needed, stopping them as soon as appropriate patient care permits, and selecting antibiotics that will be effective for a patient's specific infection without using broad-spectrum or big-gun antibiotics unnecessarily. Many hospitals now have antibiotic stewardship programs that provide education and guidance to encourage prudent and effective use of antibiotics. Another important step to slow or reduce antibiotic resistance is to prevent the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria from one person to another person. It is really critical that healthcare personnel follow the practices recommended by their infection control group, as these practices are known to reduce transmission of pathogens in healthcare settings. Outside of the healthcare setting, we can all help fight antibiotic resistance by using antibiotics exactly as prescribed by our physicians and by practicing good hygiene, including frequent hand hygiene.
I mean, we're not really getting many new antibiotics, are we? Is that just because it's not a profit margin? You know, you do better by making, you know, erectile dysfunction pills or...
or baldness cures.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the pipeline does not contain as many new antibiotics as many of us would like. But there have been some new antibiotics in the past few years, and new things will continue to come along. One of the interesting things is that some old antibiotics, like Bactrim, which is one of the oldest antibiotics known, are still effective against many antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Dr. Alex McAdam is an associate professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of the Infectious Disease Laboratory. You can read about antibiotic resistance in a question and answer feature Dr. McAdam moderated in the August 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry.
Still to come, genetically modified foods are saving the world or killing us all. We'll talk to an activist who comes down on option two next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1276.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
For people who believe that genetically modified foods are just two shelves away from the poison aisle, listening to Jeffrey Smith is like listening to the gospel. Smith is an author and consumer advocate who, for more than a decade, has been sounding the alarm about genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, in food. His work has been lauded in many circles and called everything from wild theories to blatant lies in others. Everyone agrees that he's a skilled communicator. The Health Show's Paul Tuthill recently caught up with Jeffrey Smith at a conference in Western Massachusetts and talked about what Smith considers the dangers of genetically modified food.
GMOs are organisms where genes from one species is forced into the DNA of other species. For the food we eat, there are two primary traits. The herbicide-tolerant crops are designed not to die when sprayed with herbicide. So Roundup Ready soybeans don't die when sprayed with Roundup herbicide. The other main category are the pesticide-producing crops that produce a toxin that breaks open the stomach of insects and kills them. And these are created from a technology of swapping genes between species that has never naturally existed in history until the scientists figured out what they can do a couple of decades ago.
Don't they use genetically modified organisms to create food that's more nutritious, tastes better? I mean, what's wrong with science being used to improve food?
Well, they've been promising that GMOs would feed the world, taste better, improve nutrition, but they have fallen short because their assumptions about DNA and the biology of our systems is completely false. It's based on obsolete science. In fact, the process of genetic engineering itself, irrespective of whether the gene you put in is benevolent or not, the process is fraught with unpredicted side effects. It creates massive collateral damage in the DNA. Up to 5% of the naturally functioning genes can change their levels of expression. This is why genetic engineering in its current form is not ready for prime time, even if the traits are good for you.
Are GMOs in the food that people eat? For example, were my cornflakes this morning, did it come from genetically modified corn?
I'll do you one better. I'll say that your cornflakes probably were from corn that was not only sprayed with Roundup herbicide, which was then concentrated in the corn kernel, and that's linked to cancer, endocrine disruption, Parkinson's, birth defects, etc., but the corn probably also produced BT toxin. Your cornflakes this morning might have resulted in a number of problems, which unfortunately scientists are not tracking, and we have to put it together from a variety of directions. But when they look at it, the doctors say this is way too dangerous.
Is it just corn that's being genetically modified?
No, we have soy, canola used for oil, cotton, which is for cottonseed oil, alfalfa used for animal hay, sugar, beets used for sugar, and then there's also Hawaiian papaya, zucchini, and crooked egg squash.
How prevalent is it? How widespread is it in agriculture in the United States today?
Well, there's only 9 genetically modified food crops, but because soy and corn and sugar are included, and because canola and cottonseed oil are included,
It's in everything.
We're talking processed foods. It's in most processed foods.
And there is no labeling requirement. Is that correct?
Not in the United States, in 49 other countries. So 40% of the world's population do enjoy labeling in the countries where they live. But in the United States, there are, however, states that have introduced labeling legislation. I was just speaking yesterday at the Connecticut Task Force for Labeling, testified there for 2 hours. In California, they have a ballot initiative, so the people will vote directly on whether GMOs will be labeled in that state, and that'll be election day.
I see food on the shelves now that's labeled natural. I see a lot of that, actually. Am I to take that to mean that there is no genetic modification in that?
Unfortunately, no. The word natural is defined by the company any way they want to. And the California ballot initiative will mandate that no company can put natural on a product that is also genetically engineered. So if that passes, you won't be confused anymore by that natural claim.
If I'm an organic grower, I've got a backyard garden, or maybe I'm a small farmer. Do I have to concern myself with cross contamination?
Absolutely. In fact, it would only be in the species that are the same or related to the genetically engineered ones. But contamination makes the GMO situation irreversible. In the long run, we have no technology to fully clean up the self-propagating living genetic pollution of the gene pool. And so putting it outside, putting the products of this infant science outdoors where you can permanently change nature does not make sense given our infant understanding. And then we're not only doing that, we're feeding it to everyone who eats. So this is really one of the most serious problems we've ever faced in history. The genes released today can outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. And yes, organic farmers are suffering from contamination. Sometimes they have to lose their ability to sell their products as organic, and there's very little support in this government to protect that.
Jeffrey Smith is the author of Genetic Roulette and other books about genetically modified foods. He spoke with the Health Show's Paul Tutta.
The kids have all been back to school for a little while now, and the beginning of a new school year is always a good time to begin new, healthy habits. Margot Kern from the National Institutes of Health reports that parents can go a long way toward helping their kids develop healthy eating habits and goals for physical activity in the new school year.
Children are heading back to school, and health experts like Dr. Griffin Rogers, director of NIH's National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, says it's the perfect time for parents to emphasize healthy eating and physical activity.
A new school year signals time for kids to be with friends, study new subjects, and get involved in after-school activities. With so many demands on you and your child during the school year, it's easy for healthy eating and physical activity habits to take a back seat. We want to remind parents and their children that they don't have to let busy school days and after-school activities lead to skipped meals and inactivity. In fact, healthy eating and regular physical activity may help the whole family meet the challenges of a hectic school year.
Dr. Rogers suggests evaluating the foods your child eats at school.
Whether your child eats breakfast and lunch at school, or you pack these meals for him or her, these meals should provide your child with about two-thirds of the nutrients they need for the day. When your child buys meals at school, review the menu with them and help them choose healthier foods like turkey sandwich on whole grain bread. Encourage your child to think about what he or she drinks, too. Choose water, fat-free, or low-fat milk more often instead of soda or sweetened drinks or juices.
Encouraging physical activity should also be a top priority, says Rogers.
Children should be active every day, whether they play sports, take PE, or get from place to place by walking or bicycling. Make sure your child gets at least 60 minutes or more of physical activity on most, preferably all days of the week. If your child is not used to being active, encourage him or her to start with what they can do and build up to 60 minutes a day. Some activities that your child might enjoy include jumping rope, playing volleyball, or playing catch. Replace after-school TV watching and video game use with physical activity, and help your child get involved with activities at school or in your community. Volunteer as a family to clean up a local park or a playground.
Dr. Rogers also gives tips for helping children who may be overweight or obese.
Children grow at different rates at different times, so it's not always easy to tell if a child is overweight or obese. We know that overweight and obesity tends to run in families. In addition to genes, the world in which children and their family live and work and play may contribute to overweight and obesity. If your child is overweight or obese, he or she is at greater risk for developing serious health problems such as diabetes, high blood pressure, kidney disease, and other health issues. Helping children achieve and maintain healthier lifestyle habits, such as more physical activity or healthy eating, may lower their chances of developing diabetes, high blood pressure, and other serious health problems as adults. If you think your child is overweight or obese, talk to your healthcare provider. He or she can tell you if your child's weight, height, and blood pressure are in a healthy range.
For NIH Radio, I'm Margot Kern.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.